I'm Kimberly Crenshaw, and this is Intersectionality Matters, the podcast that brings intersectionality to life by exploring the hidden dimensions of today's most pressing issues, from Say Her Name to the war on woke, DEI and CRT, and the global rise of fascism. This idea travelogue lifts up the work of leading activists, artists, and scholars, and helps listeners understand politics, the law, social movements, and even their own lives in deeper, more nuanced ways.
It's such a blessing to be here with you to share this space. I invite you to join me in this grounding meditation and invite stillness into your hearts. I invite you to close your eyes and relax your spine.
Welcome to Intersectionality Matters. I'm Shermina Nelson, Chief of Staff and Director of Community Engagement at the African American Policy Forum, the social justice think tank founded by your regular host, Kimberly Crenshaw. She'll be back next episode. I'm grateful to her for passing the mic to me today. The meditation you're hearing is led by Imani Samuels. Imani is a spiritual thought leader and the founder and CEO of Huru, a sacred space that promotes stillness and rest as a means to freedom.
And I just invite you to think of a moment where you've experienced the greatest joy, a moment of serenity, of tranquility, one where you felt alive and at peace.
It's Women's History Month, which means there's a lot of advice out there right now about self-care. There's no shortage of videos online promoting self-care, and headlines about burnout are plenty. It's a topic that's often aimed at women, and rightfully so, as historically, women have not prioritized their care. It's so easy to go through the days, months, and even years bearing the weight of emotional and mental fatigue without having the space or language to identify what we're carrying. And without that knowledge, it's difficult to create effective, sustainable self-care routines for ourselves.
Notice the scents of the air and the taste in your mouth. And notice how you are feeling inside. Savor that for a few moments. May this moment be your promised land.
If you can't remember the last time you took a moment to give yourself some care, I invite you to take the time right now. Breathe with Imani.
Breathe in and out and in and out. And one more synchronized breath in community. In and let it go.
4 years ago, Imani and other wellness practitioners joined our team at the African American Policy Forum to craft an intimate evening dedicated to Black women's self-care. We've reconvened every year since as part of AAPF's Her Dream Deferred. Her Dream Deferred is an annual week on the status of Black women. This week has a packed schedule with film screenings, panels, and workshops. Each event's intention is to amplify their experiences of Black women and girls and reclaim our narratives.
I want to thank all of our panelists today and all of our sisters sitting with us in community.
I am delighted to moderate a conversation with feminist sisters whom I have known and worked with for decades.
What a powerful and inspiring week this has been as we've centered the experiences and healing of Black women and girls.
The series serves to disrupt dominant and stereotypical narratives around Black women and our well-being.
That's my mental health crew over there.
When we started this annual conversation on wellness, we were enduring the twin pandemics of COVID-19 and rampant racism. We knew it was important to create a space to center Black women's wellness to help us weather that storm. Over the last few years, the attendance at this event has grown tremendously. We don't need to look far to understand why.
Would you go into battle without a strategy? Would that make sense?
That's Anana Harris-Paris, founder and CEO of the self-care agency, and author of Self-Care Matters, A Revolutionary's Approach. Last year, during Her Dream Deferred, Anana explained why Black women in particular need to be strategic about self-care.
There is conflict all around us, let alone the overloading of messages, the lights, the temperature on my skin, sounds. That's external messages, right? Then you've got internal ones. What's my spleen doing right now? What's going on with my heartbeat, my breath, right? So now your body and your brain's processing external and internal. And then you walk down the street and you run into racism. You run into sexism. You go into the workplace and somebody wants to touch your hair. Now you're talking about living in an environment in conflict with your natural state. So that's a good description of being at war. When you begin to not disassociate yourself from that, then you can begin to connect this notion of addressing a need. What would happen if you woke up every day and you asked yourself, what do I need spiritually and emotionally? And you had an answer. If you were able to do that, that would be the beginning of being strategic and not random about your self-care.
Anana's call for Black women to be strategic about their self-care could be life-saving advice. As a social worker who specializes in grief, trauma, and loss, I'm intimately familiar with the attachment to survival mode. And sometimes that's what we must do to get through certain waves or periods in our lives. But to truly live requires intentionality with our choices. Audre Lorde said, "Caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it's self-preservation. And that is an act of political warfare." The word warfare may seem dramatic, but think about the environment that Black women navigate. The stress from our lived experience can take a toll on our bodies, especially when that lived experience involves racism and trauma. Studies show that early life exposures to Jim Crow laws, in effect from the 1870s to the 1960s, led to higher rates of breast cancer in Black women. To this day, in the United States, Black women have the highest rates of death from breast cancer. Black women are 40% more likely to die from it than white women. Black women's maternal mortality rates tell a similar story of injustice, as we are twice as likely to die giving birth due to disparities in access to reproductive and maternal health supports. These are just a few examples from mounting evidence linking discrimination and structural racism to life-changing physical and mental health outcomes for Black women. And the effect of these health disparities span generations. The complexities of intergenerational health challenges require specialized care. Because of this, practitioners focus their expertise in exactly this arena. Practitioners like psychologist Marielle Bouquet. In a conversation during Her Dream Deferred last year, Dr. Bouquet broke down how the stress from trauma literally gets into our bones. She also explained why connecting to our bodies provides relief.
The thing that is important for us to understand in the context of the current bodies that we exist in is that we're always existing in historical bodies and generational bodies and bodies that are representative of the biology of our mothers, of our grandmothers, of the people that came well before them, and that all of the trauma that they have experienced has been accumulated across the years, across the centuries, and has made more of a disposition to even more trauma. So it creates greater tenderness in us. It creates greater stress in us. And so when we start understanding that we exist in these bodies that are old, right? It's not just the body that is, for example, my 37-year-old body. It is a body that is centuries old and is an amalgamation of my ancestors genetically and biologically. That body comes with a long and deep history. And that history has forced me and people that look like me to be chronically disconnected from myself. So when I go back into my body, or when I, as a mental health clinician, help a Black woman or femme go back into their bodies and reconnect, it's an act of self-care and mental health for that individual. But it's also a political act that we're enacting in that moment. And mental health clinicians need to orient themselves around that truth rather than just sitting in front of someone and talking to them and not really understanding the full history that comes into that therapy room with them.
Dr. Bouquet's point about the role of the clinician in our self-care journey is so important. Health practitioners with cultural aptitude are priceless resources for marginalized groups. Yet, systemic racism has long separated communities of color from getting the healthcare they need. This can exacerbate any underlying illness, and according to the Journal of Women's Health, it even robs us of our rest. The experience of discrimination can lead to significant trouble sleeping. And although Black women report lower sleep quality, studies show Black women are less likely than any other group to report sleep challenges to their doctor. This apprehension towards accessing healthcare services can create a vicious cycle of illness and lack of care. Illness, lack of care, and the cycle repeats. Dr. Shauna Murray Brown specializes in bridging this gap through decolonizing therapy for Black communities. Her critique of our healthcare system contextualizes why some Black women hesitate to speak with their doctors about challenges with rest and other health issues.
The reality is that our current mental health care system is not grounded in our original healing ways. And so when we talk about what it means to decolonize anything, it is to repatriate or to take back, to return. And when we're talking about our mental health care system, it really invites me to return to the question that I tend to ask myself, which is, how have we always healed? How have Black women historically healed? And so to decolonize mental health care means for us to reclaim and reconnect to our original healing ways, that is connecting to the land, that is connecting to the seen and unseen. Black women specifically are often put in places where we are disconnected from ourselves, and we are in environments that really almost encourage us to be in fighting with each other. And so to decolonize mental health care really requires us to say, let's bring in some of the original healing ways into the space. Let's help us create an environment where we can begin to imagine what a new world can be like.
A world where Black women can easily tap into resources for self-care. It's a vision that we avidly pursue during Her Dream Deferred. The dream of health equity for Black women may be delayed, but we refuse to accept that it's denied. That's why we invite practitioners like therapist and youth worker Jasmine Bowie to help us bridge science and spirit so that we're equipped to reconnect with our inner wisdom on how to heal.
I'm always telling folks, like, yeah, you got to create some spaciousness in your life. When you create spaciousness, you create room for all the things that you desire to land. And so breath work is really powerful for the release. Sometimes you're holding on to things that don't even belong to you. And sometimes you're holding on to things that you should have put down a long time ago. And just simply creating space to breathe, you can let your body know, like, oh, I'm safe. That my environment is safe. My body is safe. These connections are safe. And so through breathing in very specific rhythmic patterns, you are prompting your nervous system to move into what we call the calming response, that relaxation response, that parasympathetic nervous system. And it's a really powerful healing tool that connects you not only to self, but source, God, spirit, however you choose to connect and quiet the mind, quiet the spirit, be in stillness to be able to hear those divine ancestral wisdoms that live in your body.
Stillness, rest, the space to take a beat, to hear what your intuition is telling you about what you need, the resources to strategize and make that inner calling a reality. All these steps towards healing coalesce when we can slow down. That's what we're unpacking today with Imani Samuels, the life-changing effect of getting proper rest. You heard Imani's call to slow down and be present at the start of the show. Imani is inspired by the transformative power of stillness. Imani is a spiritual thought leader, speaker, and advocate for stillness and rest as a means to find peace. She's the founder of Huru, an organization that champions rest, and is on a mission to ensure everyone has access to it. Imani, welcome to Intersectionality Matters.
Thank you, Sharmina. It's a delight to be here.
So before we get into the benefits of stillness and rest, I think we should define it. So there are so many sources of information on how we should rest and what relaxation looks like. Capitalism and other influences can make it seem almost out of reach. So how do you describe what rest really is when people ask you?
Thank you for the invitation to perhaps redefine or reimagine what rest feels like. My focus is on active rest. And so oftentimes there's this synonymous perception of rest is sleep, or rest is something that we do in our non-waking hours. But active rest looks different for different people. What it really is the spaciousness to align your mind and your heart and your body. And to do those things, you really have to study yourself. And so you only know what rest looks like for you. And I've found oftentimes for me, rest looks like a walk with a loved one or by myself and being immersed in creation and nature.
What prompted you to study yourself, right? So was there a tipping point in your own life where it became clear that rest was the answer?
You know, I historically have said yes. At this moment is when my life completely changed. But when I was reflecting on it recently, there were a series of moments throughout my nearly 40 years of existence where it became so abundantly clear that rest was always integrated as an antidote to whatever I was going through. And so that looked like existential crisis. So rest being a response to a severe burnout experience that really actually compromised the care that I was taking for my children, for my girls, working so hard, unsustainable hours, and almost neglecting the proper care for them as little babies, and realizing that one had developed a rare skin condition and the doctor saying, you know, that could have turned into skin cancer had it lingered any longer. So that's kind of what I formally described as the tipping point. But I think that the reflection on my mother's experience has also been very profound in kind of the importance of rest in her life and in my life, just witnessing her and hearing her stories about integrating high school and being spat on or thrown rocks at, pursuing a math degree as a Black woman in a predominantly white institution, entering into IT in the 70s and an energy field, which is also predominantly male dominated and white. And so seeing all of the embodied trauma from those generations or those decades of experiences allowed me to reflect that rest is actually what she needed in those moments of pain. My body, which is something that I don't often talk about, but I suffer with a chronic condition, and that chronic condition causes pain. And so I've lived with pain since I was 16 years old. Every day, there are different varying levels of pain. And it hasn't been until recently that I'm making the connection between this passion that has brewed within me around rest and actually the only pain management solution being rest to help me regain kind of control of my life. And so that's huge. Like, I find myself having to energetically and physically estimate or plan for my week, my month, and be strategic about that so that I minimize the pain. And so I have to like build moments of rest within that. So that's something that's new. That's really personal and kind of micro. But then there are all of these communal facets that were an invitation to rest as well. So George Floyd's murder, the echoes across the country, Breonna Taylor's murder, the echoes across the country of we are mentally and physically exhausted and we need to rest. So there's that. There's philosophical inspiration from the great folks like Rachel Carbell or Ebony Janisse or Audre Lorde or bell hooks, and the list goes on. And so those inspirations kind of continuously cultivating the practice of rest as an ideology. There's the global pandemic. And so I'm very much an environmentalist at heart. There's this notion that even the planet has and experiences this favorable response when we rest, when there's less industrialism, when there's less production, when there are fewer carbon emissions, we're actually able to see bluer skies and breathe cleaner air. And so that's been a beautiful revelation. But I think one of the most profound whispers along this journey that made me believe and convicted to it was a little nudge from the universe as a reminder that rest is not only highly regarded in the faith that I grew up in my birth faith, but it transcends ideology. And so that little reminder, like being able to listen and hear spirit, is the moment that forced me or brushed me, invited me into understanding and studying myself a little bit more.
But you didn't just stop there. You speak a lot about freedom, right? And not being able to go back to what you saw as not being free. You could have stayed there in your personal freedom. And that voice that you're referencing, spirit, spoke to you and told you to move this outside of yourself. And so can you tell me a little bit about that voice you heard, you know, the one that moved you from practicing rest for yourself to now being an advocate, a champion of rest? Because those are two different things. You could have just held it. Like, I found this piece of heaven here, and this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to make sure I'm good. But you took on quite a task in a world that's very attached to productivity, to what we see as successful.
Yeah, I attribute the kind of wanting to evangelize or share the gospel of rest with others to the abundance I was experiencing. Like, I don't think I'd ever realized that the less that I do, the more rewarding my life will be. Like, I didn't know it. I just thought, oh, I will rest and I will feel well and I will give my mind a break. But it actually increased every facet of life. So I had a better quality of relationship with my children, with my lover. I earned more. Like, I earned more money. That is not something that I had planned for. In fact, I thought there would be retaliation for me doing less work. I scaled back. I stopped working endless hours every day and only worked 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., thinking that I was going to be fired. And lo and behold, the next year, I got the biggest raise that I've ever gotten in my career, raise and bonus. So there were these indicators of abundance, financially, physically, communally, socially, creatively, that actually validated, I would be doing humanity a disservice if I kept this to myself. It needs to be democratized. The philosophy of rest needs to be democratized.
So I want to zero in on Black women and our unique relationship to self-care, stillness, and rest. And earlier in the show, I quoted the poet Audre Lorde, who you have referenced now as well, and her guiding words on the need for self-care. And she frames it as an act of political warfare. And I'm curious, what are your thoughts on this notion of caring for ourselves and seeking stillness as a political act? Does that ring true to you?
Oh my gosh, that deeply resonates. It did then when it was written, and it still holds true. I think oftentimes this commodified self-care industry has really tarnished the perception of what care truly means. Care means to be held. It means to foster wholeness and healing. And so perhaps that can be done by getting your nails done or getting your hair done, but it can also be done by sitting still and closing your eyes and resting them for a bit, which is what our grandmothers used to do. And so I think that as we think through political warfare, we have to understand, own, and embrace that it's a human right. Rest is a human right. It is not a privilege. It is not a reward. I think oftentimes people also say, I'm in my busy season, but once I get over this hump, I'll take some time. Nope, that's not how it works. Like, every day, we have to stay true to the practice of stillness, whatever that means for you again. And we have to model it for the next generation so that they then carry on that practice in the circles that they inhabit. And to the extent that we can share that philosophy as a civil right, as a human right, then I think from a societal or global perspective, we'll have such a stronger and more connected civilization. And so there are all these kind of levels of like micro, what it means to me, what it means to our community, what it means to the planet, but really like, what does it mean for humanity to be well rested? And I think that's where societal change really kind of provokes us to think differently. Like very intentional rest fosters societal change. And once we get there, you know, we can hit the ground running and create our own promised land, so to speak.
I think we've come miles with this conversation and with people being more aware of the need for the self-care, the need for rest. I think a lot of the work still remains in not seeing it as an afterthought. That's why we were really intentional when we had the self-care event. We wanted it during the week because we needed people to see it as something that should be integrated. And I like what you said about a human right. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about the Serenity Act and how you brought this advocacy of yours into the political arena. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Serenity Act and why you found it important to hold governments more accountable for mental health and wellness?
I think this actually connects to your previous question, Shermina, around the need for Black women in particular. Like for centuries, there have been, and this is why it is an act of political warfare and an act of resistance, for centuries. We've done multiple jobs to cultivate this land, specifically the land of the Americas. We've nursed our babies. We've nursed their babies. We've tended to the land. We've fed our families, like all those jobs for centuries. And so that being passed down from generation to generation, that is unique to the Black woman. Like nobody else has done that except for the Black woman. And that's who I was dreaming of when we launched the Serenity Act. I was dreaming of how can we reclaim some of that joy and some of that peace and some of that rest for the Black woman. And once we do that, of course, we know all tides rise when we care for the Black woman. But it was really intended to be an invitation to government officials, executive leaders, and others who hold privilege and power to recognize the need for, you know, Black women have been doing this for centuries, and now we need to honor how we support their reclamation. If it's not financially like reparations, how can this be some sort of reparation for that? And so the Serenity Act is 1 week of paid mental health leave. That's really all we're asking for. And it's not a lot considering the investments that we put into pharma, the investments that we put into travel, the investments that we put elsewhere. It's really not a lot. So 1 week of paid mental health leave, which is a slight nuance and a little different from FMLA. I think people often argue, well, isn't that a little similar to FMLA? And it is, except for FMLA, again, is caring for another person. So it's the Family Medical Leave Act. We're actually caring for someone else. We're not caring for ourselves. So I'd be satisfied, and I think many would be satisfied, if FMLA were just amended just a bit to cover and account for the care for ourselves. And that's what the Serenity Act is intended to do. We actually have started to talk to government officials to see if we could pilot it in certain markets. And I'm really proud to say, even without a pilot, that Minneapolis, so Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, understood that need. So they've already done the work. It's a case study. There's a precedent. Things are really resonating with the folks who are willing and open to receive kind of this newfound, I don't even want to call it pedagogy, just newfound insight, you know? So I'm excited to do more of that.
Yeah, I'm excited to have that conversation, you know, as someone who works very closely with FMLA and other policies and procedures. There's nothing like that exists for us to take care of ourselves. And so interesting that you spoke about there being things for us to take care of others, right? Because Black women have long held the position of caregivers and providers. And we've always shouldered this weight, this pressure to be strong, right? Or at least we participate in this sort of fallible perception of what strong is, what we think it means to be seen as a strong person, the strength of a Black woman. It's what's expected. And because that's what's expected, there's this implication that we don't need rest, we don't need softness, and that our value or our worth sort of decreases if we are resting. And you spoke about that even with your job, right? You thought, if I cut this down a little bit, this now means my value has changed. And they actually saw it as, no, actually your value has increased in this space from you doing that. So I wanted to talk to you a bit about how you convince people to rest. So I imagine there's pushback because of that feeling of this is who we are. And I'll share something personal. I remember this was probably over a decade and a half ago. My therapist at the time, I was telling her all these things I do. She asked me who I was. And I gave her this whole list of things. And she said, well, who are you outside of your helpfulness? And I was just stumped. It was just kind of, she's like, everything you mentioned has something to do with what you do for somebody else, even when you don't know that that's what you're mentioning. And so who are you when you're not being helpful? And I really struggled with that. And to be clear, there's obviously nothing wrong with having a giving spirit. That is who I am, right? I've dedicated my life to this work. But it was interesting that I hadn't even made my own list of the people to give to. I wasn't on the list. So I'm curious, for people like me, and we have a relationship. I've known you now 18 years, about 18 years. And I know even with me, you've had to get on me. So how do you convince folks when they are like, rest, I got to keep going. So I am, you know, I'm a value. People need me. This is who I am. This is what I'm known for.
First of all, Shamina, I'm so grateful for your giving spirit. I really am. I'm grateful that there are moments that you can be proud of because you sweetened humanity through your giving. I'm also grateful that you recognize your need for rest. And the human mind is so fascinating. Like there are these things that allow you to remember. There are certain things that allow you to forget. There's the amygdala that holds on to certain things. So the nervous system, the neurological system, it's all connected and it's so interesting. As I continue into motherhood, I have two girls. I have an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old. I'm learning that it is not my role to convince. And I don't know if you're familiar with the gardener versus the carpenter analogy. There was some research that was done. There's this idea that the carpenter is going to show you exactly how something is done, how something is created, and then expect you to model it in that exact way. It's a very prescriptive way of parenting. While the gardener is going to offer you the space to explore your curiosities and kind of hold a container so that you're safe, almost like a net. And as you seed and water and create the conditions for things to flourish, you will start to see where their mind goes, what direction their mind goes. And hopefully you will see that their mind and their heart align in that direction. So those are the differences between kind of this carpenter mindset versus this gardener mindset. By way of business, as a solopreneur, as a startup venture founder, and a rest champion, I do not convince. I speak to people about the philosophy and allow them to determine whether it is best for them, whether it serves them well. For those who are ready to rest and those who are ripe, so they raise their hand and say, yep, I buy this, I'm ready to do it, show me how to do it, I do that. So when you say you're ready, I can teach you how to do it, or at least guide you in how to do it. Because many times people are like, I don't know how to rest. I don't even know how to sit alone with my own thoughts. I've had relatives say that to me. Like, I can't come to Uru because I don't even know how to sit with my own thoughts. I'm not ready yet. But once you are ready, and you say, I'm ready to rest, I don't know how to do it. Can you help me? And that's where I show up. That is my role as a companion. And I think that there are obviously pros and cons to that. I had a 14, 15 year of marketing and sales and advertising. So I know the actual kind of fundamentals of convincing and being compelling and having a stimulus to invite people into a product or service. But this is not a product or service. This is a way of being. This is a lifestyle change. And so that's what REST feels like.
Well, I was convinced. And I think being in your presence, Imani, is in many ways, it's compelling. You embody peace when you come into spaces. And so it's sort of like, how do I get some of that? I guess I am very much a Virgo perfectionist, like got to get things done, always multitasking, can't do one thing at a time. And so even when you came into the space today, it was immediate, like, no, stop, put all your papers down. So thank you for that. Thank you for compelling me to slow down and to rest. So the other standout topic that's come up during many of our self-care events, and we're getting ready to go into our fourth one this year, which we're really excited about, is the importance of understanding how our ancestors' experiences affect us in the present day and how we've inherited both gifts and challenges. The challenge, of course, comes from the inheritance of trauma from those who came before us and much of what they had to endure. You spoke a bit about what your mother endured, and my mother, similarly, she was part of the group that integrated her high school and, you know, experienced bullying and abuse in that space. And so we know that that trauma gets passed down to us and that stress leaves us predisposed to physical and mental illness. But the flip side of that is we also inherit tools from our ancestors to heal. So what is one of your go-to methods of healing that you've inherited from those who came before you, and how did you discover it?
I love this question. I think one of the biggest ones that I practice every day is social connectedness. Just social connectedness, just being connected with loved ones to the point where you're understanding their context and the worldview and treating them as the individual they are. So I like to spend long conversations, particularly with my girls, but also with my mother and my aunts and a few friends every day, just learning about their experiences and how they've shaped their worldview. Social connectedness. The Surgeon General just put out a new report on loneliness, and the lack of social connectedness is comparable to smoking 15 cigarettes a day, which is fascinating when you think about it. And that's above drinking daily, all the things. It increases your risk for hypertension, for cardiovascular disease, for stroke. The lack of social connectedness is that powerful. And I see it in other frameworks. I see it in research around the blue zones. So the zones or the communities around the world that have been known and proven and studied to demonstrate longevity, so long life. I've seen it in the scientific theory of happiness. And I believe in it so much that in the fall, I moved in with my friends. So my husband, myself, my girls, the four of us, we moved in with some of our best friends who also have two kids to really practice this life of communal living. Our ancestors did that through and through and through, like to no end. I remember my parents taking in all the people, my cousins and my great aunts, and really just being a second home for them. I remember my grandmother doing it as well, Rhodey. Shout out to Rhodey. And she just taking in everybody. And so I can only imagine that as it goes back and back and back and back to the continent, to the mother continent, that we were held by our loved ones on a daily basis. And I see it a little bit for friends who have direct connections to the continent. I see their grandparents and their aunts and uncles constantly in community together. When I go back and I studied in South Africa or in Morocco or in and around West Africa or even East Africa, they are villages. They are true villages. And so it requires all the things. It requires caring for those who are older and caring for those who are younger and being friends and sisters. And so social connectedness is huge, but I will just add in two more. One, dancing. Dancing, like getting some of that trapped trauma out of your body. Dancing. Dancing is huge. I love it. I love it. I have to take care of my body so I don't do it as often as I used to, but I love dancing. And I also love and enjoy and appreciate hymns. So singing or humming hymns has been a healer for me, especially when I'm grounding, which is like bare feet on raw soil. So outside on the earth, when I'm grounding, which is a whole other practice that I'd also add to that list, but singing, humming the hymns that my grandparents also hummed lives within me and serves as a healing mechanism as well.
Do you have a favorite hymn?
I do. There's a sweet, sweet spirit. Would you like me to sing it?
Oh, yes. I'm here for this.
No, I'm just kidding. There's a sweet, sweet spirit in this place. And I know that it's the spirit of my Lord. And my birth faith is Christian. It has since evolved. But I go back to that hymn time and time again, time and time again, calling on the words and phrases that healed my grandparents has been a healing mechanism for me as well.
Mm-hmm. I think mine is "Great is Thou Faithfulness." I'm not going to sing anything right now either.
That's the next podcast.
So there's more and more research surfacing around the long-term effects of racism on the body. Dr. Arlene Geronimus coined the term weathering, right? Where marginalized individuals who are exposed to stress long-term experience cellular damage to their bodies. And this damage leads to dangerous health problems as the person ages. So given the data, we can say there's a direct link between racial bias, structural racism, and negative health outcomes for Black women. When we talk about the impacts of racial bias, we often don't see this connection made to health and health equity. Why do you think that people don't see racism as a threat to our health?
My goodness, I feel like that insight just kind of touched upon so many other things and conversations that I've had just this week around health equity and the impact of race, racism, sexism. I believe that Americans in particular in this current society have been conditioned to compartmentalize the different dimensions of the worlds in which they live. And because of that, there's not a lot of connection made intentionally. I believe that we've been conditioned to think that education is separate from physical health, is separate from the economy, is separate from climate. I mean, we even refer to some of our livelihoods as industries or sectors, sectors meaning separating individual sectors, but it is all so interconnected. And to take the time to even consider the interconnectedness, one, can be overwhelming and naturally and perhaps unintentionally foster some anxiety and all those things. But also, too, it takes time to do that. And in this current society, people don't have time. They're spending most of their waking hours working. And so to make that connection and to acknowledge it, one, I also think people are being very intentional about not owning and acknowledging that there is racism in this country. So there's a full spectrum. There's folks who are in denial. There's folks who know it and want it to stay the way that it is. And then there are folks who recognize it. And on that spectrum, those who are privileged and hold the power fall into kind of the two-thirds that either know it and are intentionally trying to keep it the way it is, or who don't want to name and acknowledge it. And they hold most of the power despite the growing minority. And it's awful. I'm horrified. I'm frightened on some days by the way that we've disconnected and almost disaggregated that type of data. And in some ways, it's both causation and correlation. I think both exist. I think those two things can be true, and I think they can be addressed in a variety of ways. But racism is attacking us on all ends. I just had this conversation yesterday in the education space. It is attacking us. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If I can share a story real quick, my girls attend one of the most progressive bilingual schools in the city. There's been so much attention. It's garnered some favoritism from leaders in the city. It's one of the poster childs for how education should be disseminated. And I can count at least 7 instances of racism within the past 2 weeks, from overt, like everything from a little boy in first grade being called a black monkey, to folks using the N-word. These are students, elementary school students. To yesterday, my daughter gets in the car, I go and pick them up. And my oldest says, oh, the third graders were just testing me. She's in fifth grade. She says, the third graders were just testing me on my math. And one of them, she named them, and they're friendlies. One of them said, oh, I didn't know you were this smart. And even just that right there, like, I'm praying and saging and Palo Santoing and working in the body that that does not exist in my child's body forever and ever. Like, those micro, macro, shade, jazz, whatever you want to call them in whatever dialect that you desire, stay with you. There's a direct impact on racism to pain, trauma, and physical deterioration, mental, physical, emotional deterioration. And it's unfortunate.
The microaggressions that people would tell you don't happen until you're, you know, in this corporate space. Like, no, it's happening right here in elementary and junior high school. And, you know, the system is set up to keep that disconnection, right? And they've gone even further, as you know, with the book bans and the banning of concepts. So we have to really push back on it, because if you can block people from making those connections, and if you can block people from understanding their history, and if you can control the way our children learn and even their counterparts, right, you can really continue to perpetuate this. And so that's part of why we have our week on the status of Black women, where we have this entire week where we make space to have these conversations, to press these issues. So I was going to ask you, though, is there a piece of Huru, because you spoke about the social connectedness, right? Have you considered, or is this something that's already happening or in the works, some community spaces of rest, or would that be disruptive?
I'm so glad you asked, because they're not opposite. So social connectedness is not opposite from experiencing a solo retreat. However, I will say we have community in our solo experiences, and we offer communal experiences. So we have called them interludes of joy before. Now they're just communal stillness sessions where folks will come in and we'll sit in silence and stillness together for an extended period of time. So that happens on a monthly basis. It's open to the community, and we have kind of a set date and time for that. We also have taken, and for folks who don't know, the Huru experiences, we follow the FAR methodology. So food, activity, rest. We feed you, we guide you through some type of practice. It could be meditation, it could be a walk, it could be humming a hymn, it could be grounding. And then we rest collectively, or for the solo experiences, we invite you to rest. So our host says, go rest, we'll come back, we'll check on you. And that's kind of the rhythm of what the solo experience looks like. We feed you, we guide you, we invite you to rest, food, activity, rest. And that can be for a weekend, that can be for a week long, whatever you desire. We take a flavor of that, so an abridged version, and we offer it in our communal sessions And we also offer it to organizations who are interested in sharing it with their employees or with their grant recipients or with their business partners. So we've had a lot of success in taking like a 90-minute version of that and taking it into the workplace. I think it is the future of work. I believe rest is the future of work. That's a whole other conversation as well. For the solo experiences in our flagship, which is in Washington, D.C. So we have spaces all around the country in New York, in California, and D.C. There is a card that the guest receives from the previous guest. And then there is a card for the guest to write the next note to the next guest. So there is this community and connective tissue between guests, even in the solo experience. And really, it's because you're never alone. Like, you're never alone. And we want to remind people that they're never alone. And again, we try not to convince, and we try to do this work in collaboration. So there's none to dismantle and decolonize the way in which we do work. So there's not a leader who's then passing down everything to you or giving everything to you. There's collaboration. And so our chefs are part of that care. Our practitioners are part of that care. And fellow guests are part of that care. So that's how it shows up, social connectedness.
Before we go, I want to make sure I leave our listeners, especially Black women who follow the show, with some practical takeaways on how they can at least begin to dream of a real self-care routine and one that is sustainable. We know we're all different, but are there any common places that you can tell us to start?
Yeah, I think the simplest thing is breathing. The simplest thing is taking stock of your breath, being mindful of your breath, whether it's a shallow breath, a deep breath, a fast breath, breathing, taking a deep breath, opening your thoracic lung. And you can even say an affirmation as you're breathing, like, I breathe in abundance. I exhale loss. I breathe in freedom. I exhale grief, pain, whatever it may be. That's the easiest. Breath is prana, which is life. You have it. It's accessible to you anytime, anywhere, for free. I think that we're doing this work in community and in collaborations. Like, there are services and products that will invite you to pause as well. So I think you have to own creating time throughout your day. So actually blocking time off, not to not have a meeting, but to actively rest. And thinking about what that looks like, thinking about the sentiment. So making a to-be list versus a to-do list. I want to feel like, I want to feel loved. I want to feel full. I want to feel cared for. I want to feel whatever that is for you, prioritizing that sentiment and then organizing your activities and your milestones for the day to fulfill that sentiment. I think taking a walk, especially for those who are still in corporate, you have to get out of those walls, because just like in other walls where spirit exists or where nature exists or other places, there is a type of energy that exists within corporate walls that was not designed for you. So take a break, take multiple breaks to walk outside or even just stand outside for a period of time during your work day. I also believe that what's accessible to us is a tea. So like Ajourne Tea House, founded by Latonya Coakley. Ajourne, even just Ajourne, like that name is intended for you to pause. It is an invitation. Being mindful of whenever you're drinking the tea or eating the meal, of what that supply chain was. So I'm thankful to the gardener, to the farmer, to the clouds, to the rain, to all who allowed this meal to be here. All of that is resting. That's active rest. That's a sign that's demonstrating gratitude, but that's active rest. And then the other thing I'll say is, especially if you are one to commute or to spend time in your home cooking or cleaning, take some time to release your thoughts, either through journaling, which actually I don't practice. I tend to voice note. So whatever thoughts that I might journal, I just voice note it on my phone. Nobody else sees it, hears it. I don't even hear it until I want to go back. But there are many voice notes that I have not listened to. I just get it out of my body, whatever it is. It could be joyful or it could be not so joyful. But allowing that to come out so that you can have a good night's rest and then wake up the next morning to integrate rest into your day again. So the idea of releasing, breathing, being mindful in what you consume, I think those are three simple, accessible practices that you can do today, right now.
Releasing, breathing, and being mindful of what you are consuming, and also mindful of the space around you, the energy within the walls. That sounds like a good start. I also like the to-be list. I am the queen of a to-do list. So a to-be list is something I'm going to incorporate.
I will also add the dichotomy of like doing and being. Like, we've done doing really well. Your body will tell you when it's time to be. And so just listening to your body, like that embodied wisdom, the fast heartbeats, listen to your body, the slow heartbeats, the pain in the back, the upper back, the lower back, the headaches, the tiredness or the fatigue within your legs or your feet. Like, just listen to your body. It will tell you exactly, the butterflies in your stomach, it will tell you exactly the direction that you need to move. Listen to the wisdom of your body.
Yeah. And make space to listen to it. Even if it's the 5 minutes, make space to listen to it. Well, thank you, Imani, so much for joining me on Intersectionality Matters. It's been a pleasure and honor, always is, to chat with you.
Thank you, Charmaine. It's been a delight. Thank you for this platform, for allowing diverse voices and perspectives to just come be and share. I appreciate it. I appreciate you.
This episode of Intersectionality Matters was produced by senior producer Nicole Edwards, with support from Sanaa Hashmi, Kristen Penner, Jocelyn Walker, and the team at the African American Policy Forum. Mixing by Sean Dunham. To support our show, subscribe, leave a review, and follow us on social media. I'm Shamina Nelson. We'll be back soon.
Louis Scarcella was the greatest homicide detective of his generation.
I am the protector of these people. I am the guardian that they need.
Derek Hamilton was the best jailhouse lawyer of his.
And the law was my girlfriend. It was all I had.
What happens when a group of convicted felons take on the cop who put them away?
We gotta attack Scarcella.
Come and get me.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.